Welcome to The Motivated Mind, where I challenge you to expand your perspective on how to achieve a successful life through motivational lessons, reflections, and interviews with other motivated minds. Welcome back to The Motivated Mind, a top 100 health podcast, thanks to each of you. This is episode 400, and I'm your host, Scott Lynch. If I've brought you any value, please be sure to leave a review, hit that subscribe or follow button, and please be sure to share the podcast. Thanks for making The Motivated Mind part of your story. This is a very special episode, episode 400. And being that it's a special episode, we have a very special guest that joins the pod, Cheryl Hunter, a best-selling author, speaker, and media personality who shares her message worldwide on outlets including People Magazine, Goalcast, Dr. Phil, NBC News, Dr. Oz, CNN, Fox, PBS, and more. Cheryl didn't set out with a message to share, but while traveling abroad as a teenager, she was kidnapped and held captive by criminals who eventually left her for dead. Cheryl survived this life-changing event and used her experience to help people rise after adversity. Today, in addition to writing and producing for HBO, CBS, Paramount Pictures, and NBC, Cheryl helps establish experts become world-renowned by leveraging the power of major media. Cheryl and I dive into the influence of her childhood and how her serene small town inspired her journey to Europe. The pivotal moment when choosing to accompany a man with a camera in France altered her entire life trajectory. Her compulsion to survive. How years later, running only shifted her physical location, not the mental prison she endured. How helping others in pain became a therapeutic anchor in a life that seemed to endlessly circle back to her haunting trauma. Going through the metaphoric open door as part of our healing process. And finally, the strength found in forgiveness and the transformative power it grants us. I hope you all enjoy our conversation. A quick content warning. This episode contains discussion of death, suicide, and sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts and needs support, please call 988 or visit 988lifeline.org. If you or someone you know is a victim of sexual assault and needs support, please call 800-656-HOPE or visit rain.org. Having spent over a decade in the cannabis industry, I've witnessed many consumers, myself included, grappling with the overwhelming abundance of options and information available, especially when it comes to navigating the thousands of cannabis strains. It's like navigating a maze. And driven by this challenge, my team and I embarked on a journey 4 years ago to change this narrative. Our goal was to provide consumers with the data and education necessary to make informed decisions, enhance their cannabis experience, and ultimately improve their lives. Today, I'm grateful and happy to announce that we've launched Hashdash, the world's first personalized cannabis matching platform that leverages over 637,000 cannabis strain data points to match you with your favorite cannabis that aligns with your unique preferences. Our platform centers around three key pillars: matching, community, and education. All three are aligned with our mission of empowering cannabis enthusiasts and newcomers alike, transforming confusion into clarity in the vast world of cannabis consumption. Say goodbye to the guesswork. Discover, learn, and elevate your cannabis experience with HashDash. Sign up for free at HashDash.com and find your cannabis match. That's HashDash.com.
You grew up in Colorado, correct?
Yes, in the very remote Rockies, the flyover zone.
And small town, big town, medium-sized town, what was it like?
Not really a town. Oh. We were on a rural route about 15-20 minutes from the bustling metropolis of Rye, Colorado, which had at the time, it boasted a stoplight that flashed yellow in one direction and red in the other, since has been replaced with a stop sign. and San Isabel, it was nestled between Rye and San Isabel, Colorado, which has no stoplights or stop signs. So it kind of gives you an idea of the bustling metropolis of that area.
It's funny that a stoplight is used as a symbol for describing the size of a town, because I grew up in southern New Hampshire and our town had one stoplight too, as well, one intersection. And anytime I would describe the town to people that lived or didn't know where New Hampshire was on a map, like we were talking about, the four corners or the stoplight was the single indicator to describe that's the size of the town. But even so, my town sounds a little bigger than where you grew up.
It does. It sounds far more fancy and highfalutin than cowboy country Colorado. Where I lived, it wasn't where the ski areas are. The mountains are just as high and glorious. And the San Isabel National Forest, for the namesake of San Isabel, the town, is the largest national forest in Colorado. So there's some majesty to it. But given it's just cowboy country and they built no ski areas, there was no real civilization. There was no signs of civilization from our mountain horse ranch. It could have been 200 years ago. But thinking of places like New Hampshire, oh, it just sounds so fancy. There was a place called Rye in New York that we'd go, oh, somewhere there's a town called Rye that has civilization, and highly likely they've got more than one stoplight.
this is true. This is very true. So you're in this small town that has now since turned into a single stop sign. What did you do growing up? What was your pastime, or how you kept your mind and body busy?
Rodeoing and horse shows. We used to train horses. I grew up on a horse ranch. And there's a term called breaking horses, you know, when you take them from being untrained to trained. And my father, who's a third generation rancher himself, used to say, you don't ever want to break a horse because then you break its spirit. You want to partner with the horse in such a way that all those, you know, the Western movies or that show a horse being broken and they fight you. Why would you want that? You're going to create a lifelong partnership with this animal. So that was one of the things I did, is train horses and ride them and show them. And I loved it. I would sit on my horse and face backward, bareback, and use his hind end as my desk, and I would sit out there and do homework on him or read.
That's remarkable. It's funny. I am familiar with horses because I dated a woman years ago that was into Western. She did poles, barrel racing, etc. And so a lot of our weekends were occupied going to these barrel races. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever met a group of women that are that collectively courageous, hopping on a 1,200-pound creature and riding it around this arena. And not only that, the bond that they had was remarkable. You know, I think a lot of people outside of that community think, oh, a horse is like a pet. but not from what I experienced. And I will say, I rode a horse maybe a dozen times, one being bareback. We'll never do that again as a male, but it was a cool experience nonetheless. And so I can appreciate that world that you grew up, that you came from, this kind of horse culture community.
It's so cool that you've got some experience of it, going to these gymkhanas and rodeos like that.
That's the word. Thank you, gymkhanas and rodeos. Yeah, I actually, funny enough, I built a pole barn on our property. We have 6 acres. We're out in the middle of nowhere. It's beautiful. It's quiet. Love the solitude. But it's a 30 by 30 that I built, 2 stories, and it's wonderful. We have all of our toys and stuff in there now at this point, but no horses in there. So where did life go from there? Right? Did you stay in that town for a while? Did you get itchy and have to scratch that itch, right? Like, there's got to be more out in the world. There's got to be something else beyond my one light town with the yellow blinking light.
There were days where I'd go out to contemplate. And like I said, I would do my homework sitting on my horse, and I would just go sit in the meadows, and I'd go hop on him or lie on the ground among the horses and cows and look up in the sky and see the planes flying over. When I say it's a flyover zone, there really are a lot of planes flying over. And I would think as a young girl, wow, I want to be the girl in the plane looking at the girl on the ground on the meadow. And if I stare at that plane hard enough, I could get just sucked up inside of it, and I would be the little girl on the plane looking at the little girl on the ground. And I thought, well, in order to be her, I'm going to have some way of helping people, doing something for people. And yeah, I'm good at riding horses and breaking and training, or, you know, not breaking and training them, but there are people way better than I am. So that's out. I don't know what I'll do. And then as I grew older and became a teenager, I thought, God, I have got to get out of here. I read of places in books and see places in movies and TV shows, and I have to get out of here. I need to go to those places and see people that I'm not related to by blood. And I took a personal day, otherwise known as playing hooky, and hopped on my mini bike and rode to the nearest convenience store, which is a drive, you know. There weren't any in Rye. I had to go all the way to Colorado City to the Loaf and Jug. And I went down there and bought a Glamour magazine for career advice. That's what a teenage girl might see for bona fide career advice. And they were talking about how they were always looking for models. Now, I had no aspirations for that, but I was like, oh, well, there's an idea. If I told my folks I want to be a model, how are they going to argue? I can't do that in Rye, Beulah, San Isabel, Walsenburg, any of the nearby towns. So that might work. I'm on the boys' basketball team. That probably means I'm tall enough. I'm going to do this. And so, you know, I waited until I graduated high school, but talked my best friend into going to Europe with me. We made all the plans, got the Eurail passes, the whole nine. This was going to be my way to figure out. I said on this trip, it was just a finite trip over the summer, but I was going to figure out a way once I got there to stay in the big city. I thought, well, you know, initially, I obviously can't model in Rye. Where do they need models? I guess Europe, isn't that where all the fashion comes from? You know, so that's where the idea for Europe was hatched. And I just thought, this is a brilliant idea. I got it from Glamour magazine. How bad could it be? Right?
It's got to be a great idea.
I mean, right? What else do you need? Just half-baked plan. And so we get to Europe. We literally get to France, and a man with a big camera around his neck walks up. He's like, hey, are you a model? I could make you one. I was like, do you see how easy it is to become a model in Europe? And he says, just come with me and my friend over there. Now, I told my best friend, she's like, oh, over my dead body. But you see, she wanted to go home afterward. I wanted to find a way to stay in the big city. I don't care what the hell big city, just a big city. I did not want to go back to somewhere between Rye and San Isabel, Colorado. Just no, a flat no. So I thought, okay, this is probably not the smartest idea, but I'm a ranch girl. I'm smart. I'm strong. I know how to drive a tractor. I mean, come on, how hard could it be? And so I went with them. Now, I mean, look, it doesn't take a whole lot of deducing here to realize that was not a particularly good decision. They asked me if I wanted some wine. And I'm like, no, no, I want to be good to take the photos. Now, I was very, very naive. Yeah, I was strong and smart and knew how to drive a tractor trailer and a horse trailer and all that stuff. But I wasn't a match for these criminals. I said, I didn't want the wine. They were like, well, do you want cocaine? All models have cocaine. And I'm like, oh my God, I had never seen a drug or I was very naive. And they handed me this packet, this foil like envelope. And I opened it up and it's light brown. And I'm like, okay, I am blonde and from Rye, Colorado, and I don't know much. And I'm like super sheltered, but isn't cocaine supposed to be white? I didn't do anything with it. They gave it to me as I was going into the bathroom. I brought it back out. I mean, I'd seen like movies and stuff, and I came out and I was going like faking like I had it. Took it, sniffed it, or whatever the hell, or whatever you're supposed to do with it. And then they offered me the wine again. I'm like, no, no, I want to be good for the photos. And they said, don't be such an American. And so I was like, oh, oh, like I'm standing out, like I'm not blending it. So I had the wine. The next thing I know, I'm sitting in the front seat of a car with my head kind of hanging out an open window like a dog with my tongue out. And we're going up these windy roads. And I'm just like, we're turning and turning and turning and turning and turning. And I'm like, this is not good. And I leaned over and said, hey, when are we going to take the photos? Like thinking that's still happening. When are we going to take the photos? When are we going to shoot the photos? And throughout the entire ordeal, they took me to this abandoned, I guess it was a construction site that was like the plastic that there is when there's construction nailed up everywhere. And it was just a cement floor. I guess that's what it was, right? But the whole ordeal, I kept saying, when are we going to take the photos? When are we going to take the photos? I was so young and naive. I still thought after all they were doing to me, and you could fill in all the gory details with your mind, but they were so sadistic, like trying to drown me and beating the shit out of me. Like, why? Like, do all the other stuff, but why that? Like, why the torture, you know? And I just kept saying, when are we going to shoot the photos? Thinking that it was still going to turn out my way, you know? I was still going to get what I had gone to Europe for, you know? I don't know why, but after all of it, you know, days later, they decide that they're going to let me go. Now, why? I don't know. I'd seen their faces, for God's sakes. But they take me. I'm in this car and just kind of push me out. Like I'm this slump of a body, you know, like just push me out into this grassy area. And meanwhile, I'm in the car. I'm looking there. I go, oh, this is a Mercedes. I've been in a Mercedes now. Like, that's how naive I am. And inexperienced in small town, you know. But so they push me out onto the ground and I just kind of fall there in this lump of person. And the man goes, darling, like fucking darling, right? Darling, like I'm his lover or girlfriend or some damn thing. And I look my head back and he starts shooting photos. I actually decided to become a model anyway. I mean, it's not the first damn thing that I did. First thing I did was run for my life. And the guy followed me, by the way. That's a whole other story. But I decided, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to do this anyway. Not like because I gave a damn about being a model, but it's like I go, there is no freaking way I'm now going to go back to the ranch and have this hell going on between my ears. There is no way I will rot up there and die. There is no way. I at least have to keep my mind occupied. I decided in my limited resources that what I was going to do to overcome what had happened is just pretend it didn't happen. Like I never spoke a word to it. And every time the thoughts came up in my mind, I would just try and push those down. That was a really ineffective way of dealing with it. But I was like, I'm just going to figure out how the hell does one become a model? Because then I can live in some big cities and travel the world. And I actually did it. I mean, I became quite successful at it. I was the worldwide Coca-Cola girl, for God's sakes. Lived all over the world, worked all over the world. Kept myself very distant from people. I became like funny and a good joker and used to speak in accents and just anything to keep people from coming anywhere near me, lest they be able to sense or smell on me how damaged and ruined I felt. There was just like, I thought if anybody got near me, they would know something was so broken and ruined. I just couldn't let anybody close. Mm-mm. Luckily, in the modeling business, nobody gives a shit about you. They don't want to know. It's like, you are a human meat suit. Please come here and put on this outfit or wear this lipstick or eyeshadow or what have you. They don't want to know you. They don't care. They don't want you to talk. Ideally, if you don't talk and just stand there and smile or pout or what have you, depending on the product, it's better that way. So, you know, I was like, my people.
It felt like a safe space for you.
It really was, right? I mean, all the men, by and large, are gay. So I was like, thank God. They don't give a shit about me. The clients don't give a shit about me. They don't want me to talk. They don't want to know me. So I, like no kidding, it was my people. Exactly what I needed.
It's still remarkable. Even though you're describing this industry as silent and, you know, these are my people, that at the core of who you are, there's a lot of resilience for the fact that you still picked it up. You were running away from everything, but you really weren't at the same time, which I think speaks volume to the courage and the resilience that you do have, right?
Thank you. And, you know, initially, it's a lot more sort of a base drive or compulsion than resilience or anything that seems sort of highfalutin, as we might say on the ranch. It's like basic survival drive. There's a compulsion to survive. And I got very clear quite quickly I cannot continue to live the way I am. And what I mean by that is when I was captive and I was physically held there, drugged, kept there by them, I thought I just need to be free. Everything in life will work. It will be perfect. It's just as soon as I'm free, everything will be wonderful. Life will be great again. And then I was free and I was, nope, that solved nothing. That's just location. I am now more captive than I've ever been because I was captive between the ears and I kept replaying what had happened. And every time I would remember something else and was horrified by it. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I couldn't think. I was driven by thoughts of revenge and retaliation. And all the while I'm trying to pretend it's not happening. So there was this internal war. And I knew I could never tell anyone or I would be completely abandoned and shunned, I thought. And my parents would make me go home. I knew I'd have to find a way to end that pain or end it all. There were no two ways. And I thought, okay, look, I'm not the first person to go through adversity, something hard, a challenge. Everybody goes through something hard, but there are people that have gone through way worse than I am. I have. What can I learn from them? And yes, there's books and I read the books and like Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, brilliant, right? But there was something that I felt I needed to do for myself, which was to learn something myself rather than being taught what other people had learned. I needed to discover, like the process of discovering what would be therapeutic or helpful or healing was going to truly be cathartic. And the most I revealed to my mother, with whom I was very close, was I'm depressed. She goes, you mean like bored? No, I mean like bona fide depressed. And she said, well, without me telling her anything, what the hell is she going to, how is she going to counsel me? She said, there is an old adage, which is if we are hurting, there's always someone who's hurting worse. Find those people, help them. And so I started volunteering at old age homes. I thought, well, I don't know who's hurting worse. I'm young, screwed in the head, and I've got no future. Oh, old, screwed in the head, and I've got no future. Nobody wants to listen to those people. At least people listen to younger people. And I went and sat at these facilities, these boarding care facilities, and would at first just listen to them. And there were, back then, you know, Holocaust survivors, war vets, people who'd gone through the unthinkable. And at first I just sat and listened. And oh God, they were thrilled to have someone listen. And I was thrilled to not have to listen to what was going on between my own ears. And I just listened. But then before long, I started thinking, you know what? Here's two people that both have gone through this similar type of circumstance. This one went on to live a productive, fruitful life. That one understandably did not. Why? Why do they each end up in those positions? How? And I made it my work, my job, my mission to understand and then to codify it and to turn it into some methodology that I could use. My mom was a lifelong teacher. And she was a director of curriculum instruction for school districts, went on to become a professor, college professor, who taught teachers and instructors and like that. She helped me turn this into an educational framework. Now, I didn't tell her why I was so obsessed with overcoming adversity. That was never part of the equation. I'm just fascinated. It's just so interesting. It's a human condition. And I started giving it away to other people who were survivors of violent crime, sexual assault survivors, trafficking survivors. And it was working on me, but I thought, God, if it works, let me help some people. And it was working with all of them. And I thought, huh, maybe this is how I'm supposed to help people, give this away. I'm better at this than riding horses. This may be my thing.
It's your going back to laying in the field, looking up at the airplanes. That was your capsule going at 40,000 feet cruising altitude, helping those laying on their back in their own fields, right?
Wow, that's brilliant how you put that. Oh my God. I've never thought about it like that. Oh my God, that's so rich. Yes.
That's why it's so nice to share our stories with other people. They pick up pieces that we lived but might not see, right?
God, we just get too myopic. We're too close to it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Laying on the back in the field. Holy shit. That's so symbolic. Man, you're good. Scott Lynch, holy shit, that's good.
So I have a trillion questions still, but where was, you said, you know, your friend was with you. Did she, from the sounds of your story, wasn't with you when you said yes to the?
Oh, God, no. I ditched her.
Okay. And so at what point in your journey of not only healing other people, but healing yourself, did you then open up and share with your mother? Or even, I don't know if you stayed in contact or communication with your friend. At what point did all of this healing make you comfortable at a point to say, I can share this now with my mother, with my friends, with my community?
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
One of the things I had gone on to do in order to heal was I took personal development seminars and programs and coaching, things like that. I had heard this phrase from my mother, go through the open door. Now, she didn't invent the phrase, but I had heard it enough times that I thought, huh, well, what the hell is the open door? You know what? Here's what I'm going to say the open door is. Whatever somebody recommends to me. A book? Okay, I'll read it. A program? Oh, okay, I'll do that. Whatever it is, I'm going to allow the open door to be recommendations from people. And I took personal development programs and I had taken all that they had to offer. And I asked, well, what else do you got? I mean, I feel really good when I was there and not always so great when I wasn't. So they said, well, you can be trained to lead the programs. And I was like, oh, that's not really what I want to do with my life. I was writing and pitching television shows that I'd created. And I was like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do with my life. And they said, well, here's the thing. If you get trained to lead the programs, you become really the author of them, so to speak, because you're generating them for other people. Plus you can do it part-time or as a volunteer. And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I want to do. I'll do it as a volunteer. And I'd gone on to do this quite successfully and led programs for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people at this point. And I was leading a session on forgiveness. This week's session happened to be about forgiveness. Now, this is years after the kidnapping. And I'm leading this session, and I've never told anybody, not a person. I had gone to psychotherapy for a long time and talked about hypothetical hypothetical, non-consensual sex. Not like gang rape by horrid criminals while being tortured and like this, waterboarded. Nothing. No one, I had told. So I'm leading an exercise on forgiveness. And this woman starts waving her hand violently as I'm positing that anyone can forgive anything. And she says, no, and she runs up to the front of the room to the microphone and starts recounting the tale of the genocide and the horrors that she and her family went through. And they escaped, moved to this country, and then the torture that she and her children had gone through here at the hands of her husband. It's horrible. And she's saying some things cannot be forgiven. And the room is siding with this woman to the point where this man stands up, throws down his notebooks and says, this is bullshit, and walks out of the room. And I've been leading these programs for a while, and there's hundreds of people in the room. And I'm like, I am actually about to lose the room for the first time ever. And I'm a skilled leader. And I stopped and had this conversation with myself. Why am I still holding this in? I am no longer a child who's afraid for my life or running for my life. I am no longer someone who's terrified and thinks that I'm filthy and ruined and disgusting. Whatever I was protecting is no longer what's happening here. And I shared my story for the first time. It was just silent. People sat down. They'd been milling around at the back and walking out, and people just sat down. And this woman started sobbing and saw that forgiveness isn't about condoning what happened. It isn't about saying, hey, that's all right. Go ahead, do it again. It isn't even about setting them free. It's about setting yourself free. And it hit me that the final step in that educational framework that I'd created was, in fact, being able to claim what occurred. There was the final step was complete that night when I was able to own and claim it and give voice to that which had occurred. Now, look, in terms of healing from trauma, it doesn't mean we have to publicly share. For some, it's, you know, hey, can I share this with a trusted friend, a therapist, a counselor, a spouse, a partner, someone? For others, it might be a support group. In my case, it was this group. And I then realized I now must raise my voice, because at the end of that session, people lined up. Like I literally stood there for, I don't know, an hour and a half, 2 hours talking to people afterward. And they all started something by saying, I've never shared this before, or nobody knows this. That's how it started. And I've gone on now and done hundreds of speaking engagements. And every time, without exception, people line up and the same thing happens. I've never said a word about this to anyone. And then they'll tell me whatever their story is. And I thought, I must share my story for all those people who, for whatever reason, cannot. I am now no longer a child. I have overcome. I have truly healed. I have found a way. It's possible for people. They need to understand it's possible to overcome any adversity, no matter what. I'm going to spend the rest of my days sharing that.
It's a beautiful mission. And you've opened up a door of acceptance for people, acknowledging, right? Giving them the platform and microphone to talk about it. It's truly remarkable when you understand how many people have had some form of suffering and trauma in their life, and then they don't talk about it, and then they bury it, and then it gets bigger. And I'm certainly not trying to compare, you know, someone's trauma with someone else's, but, or give it appropriate comparison, I guess, but it's like receiving a bill and throwing it under the, it doesn't make it go away. It never will make it go away. Or nobody talks about money or finances in this country. And so everybody has a misunderstanding of what managing your finances looks like, because there is no goalpost, there is no reference point. It's kind of like when you're in driver's ed, one of the things you're taught is when your car's stationary, how do you learn when the car's moving, right? Oh, well, you look at a stationary object, right? A building, maybe a fence post, maybe a telephone post, so on and so forth. And when other people are able to disclose their trauma, or willing to, confident to do that, that's that driver's ed, that goalpost, that movement that, okay, I have my reference point now. This is the moment. This is where I'm mustering the courage to be able to vocalize what I went through, which certainly, I mean, you know better than anybody that that's not easy. And so I think having a reference point in someone saying, I went through this, is a great signaling or energy to say, I too can share this. I too can overcome this. I too can use this as a benefit to my life. And again, certainly not comparing stories here, but when my best friend took his life in 2015, it took me years to understand how to take something so dark and be able to extract something good out of it, or use it for something good. And that took a lot of therapy, a lot of talking to other people. But similar to your experience, talking to other people about suicide, or losing someone they love, or that's close to them, a friend, a family member, a colleague, gave them the platform and the opportunity to say it's okay to talk about it. And that you're not broken or different or any of those things. And I think that's the other piece of trauma, at least that I've started to understand, is that through trauma, we sometimes think that we're damaged, or we're too different, or we're not good, or we don't fit into society, or onto those train tracks. And then we realize, or have these conversations with everybody else, we go, ah, okay. So what I'm actually comparing myself to is far from reality, because that's not really what's going on behind closed doors. There's much more than what meets the eye. And I think that's why vulnerability and conversations and opening up and being courageous, such as yourself, to talk about this to thousands and hundreds of thousands of people and me and my audience, is a priceless and powerful tool that now no one can strip you of. And the steel of that is becoming really fucking strong. And it's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. It was something that came to the front of my mind. At this time, I was volunteering leading these personal development programs, but my day job was writing network TV. I had sold some shows, and I could see the power that major media had to shape the collective conversation, you know, create these water cooler moments where everyone's talking about the same thing. And I thought, wow, what if major media could be used to bring a conversation like this out to the world? It's possible to overcome adversity. And so I made that my mission. I'm not just going to share my story, but I'm going to do it through major media. And I was in major media, so I thought, oh, this is going to be so easy. I already know the business. I'm connected. Do you know, it took me a decade to get out on to TV shows and the Dr. Phil's and People magazines and all this. I finally did it, but it took me almost a decade because I knew how major media worked, but I didn't know how major media worked. And that I just didn't know anything. I was just blinded by my passion to help people and make a difference. And I kept doing everything wrong and doors were closing everywhere I went. But by the time I really had gotten out in a big way, like hundreds of millions of views, and I thought, God, this is it. You know what? It hit me. There is a whole industry dedicated to helping people overcome trauma and adversity. I'm going to respectfully step back now and leave this to the psychologists, psychiatrists, and mental health professionals. There is nothing in place to help someone on a mission share their story and their mission with the world. Nothing exists. If it took me a decade and I worked in network TV, these mission-driven people don't stand a snowball's chance in hell. Oh, God, my cowboyisms keep showing up. But they don't stand a snowball's chance in hell of getting out there. And so I was like, I've got a new mission. That's what it is. And I pulled together the people that I met on the way, the TV producers and journalists. And I was like, here's what I'm thinking. Is this crazy? Why is this a bad idea that I have here? I want to encircle people with a mission and help them get out in front of millions. Am I crazy? And they were like, wow, we could use media for good. That's why I got into the business, they would say. And so that is the mission. And now look, I'm clear, not everybody that's lived through adversity wants to share their story with the world. And also there are people who want to share their mission or their passion with the world, and they've never lived through adversity like on the scope that I'm referencing. Everybody lives through adversity. Everybody lives through trauma. But they want to share something because they know it'll help people. It doesn't matter what it is. I think what's going to change this world is going to be people on a mission to help being known, is having the water cooler moments of the world be conversations for possibility instead of conversations about divisiveness or what's wrong. You know, that's what's going to uplift this planet. I mean, hell, you do that every day, sharing stories that designed to help people.
It brings, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier, it brings people together, which I think is one of the most necessary things that we need on this planet right now. I despise politics. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I can't stand it. And the amount of division, specifically in the United States, it's hard to watch. It's hard to hear. And maybe this is oversaid, so it gets diluted in its meaning, but we're same people spinning around the damn sun on this big empty space, and yet we argue and fight and look at each other like we're each the enemy. And for what? It doesn't register, or it can't be put through my filter of makes sense, because it makes no goddamn sense to me at all. Each side is weaponized to go against each other and fight and blame the other side. And I sit there and think, like, everybody on both sides is being played like a damn fiddle. And it's sad, because taking something away from somebody for whatever reason you think it's a good thing never turns out or makes you feel good. But when you give people things, I'll tell you what, not only does it make the other person feel really, really good, but it makes you feel really, really, really fucking good. And that is a source of fuel that is absolutely endless. Eventually taking that fuel source, the MPGs on that, the miles per gallon, are absolutely atrocious. The MPGs, the miles per gallon on giving, on sharing, on adding value to someone, on helping someone, those are like a damn hybrid or an electric car or whatever you want, a glider. And if more people could just realize that and see through the veil of bullshit, I feel like collectively as a species, we would be much better off floating on that rock, spinning around that sun. And I mean, I've engaged with now hundreds of people that have beautiful missions that have changed so many other people's lives. They glow, they carry themselves completely different in life. And then I see or witness or have bumped into people that take and they're heavy, they're dark, and they don't see opportunity, and they sink everywhere they go. And logically, when you look at those two types of people, man, I don't want to go with the latter. That sounds like a life of absolute misery and creating more misery. And for what? For what? And so anytime I meet people such as yourself that are those floaters, those ones uplifting, making that rock a better place, those are special types of people. And I don't know about you, and I'm sure your community is like this, but I want to be around people like that. And people talk a lot about energy, but even when we first hopped on this microphone and turned on the camera, you were a ball of goddamn energy. And that's the type of people that everybody should want to be surrounded with.
It's so beautiful what you're talking about, Scott, because I think we tend to look at the chasm that's arisen through this divisiveness and the specifically by the being on opposite sides of the aisle politically, that I think we tend to look at this chasm as irreparable. But what if it were just as simple as giving versus taking, and even starting by giving something so simple that costs nothing, the benefit of the doubt? This is someone who wants a nice life. They want to have someone to love who loves them. They want to care for their family and be cared for. They want a warm meal, a roof over their head. You know, just simple benefit of the doubt. One of the things that it's funny as you say this, one of the things that came to mind for me is we tell our clients, these mission-driven people that we help get out in front of the world on media, we tell them to become a giver, not a taker. And it's just one simple fragment of the work, but it's, if you're reaching out to the gatekeepers and trying to get out there in media, how you position, are you taking something from them and getting them to give you something? Or are you being someone who bestows? Are you someone who has something to give and provide? And God, I looked at it. It made me go, oh, it's really helpful inside of the context that you just created. It is helpful to look at life from that perspective on a macrocosm. How can I give? What can I give? And it really comes down to, most importantly, those things that can't be bought or sold. You know, how do I give someone my time and attention and listen to their experience, what they've been through? How do I give my time? How do I give my attention and my love and my true care? God, it's just, your conversation is extraordinary. I'm so uplifted.
I would put an asterisk, our conversation. I've loved it. Our conversation has been amazing. Well, Cheryl, this has been phenomenal. Where can people continue to follow you, your journey, and become part of your mission, support you in your mission?
My website is CherylHunter.com, C-H-E-R-Y-L, Hunter.com. That's probably best. There's just links to everything from there.
I love it. I love it. This has been wonderful. And I know you've talked about this a lot. However, thank you for talking to us about it, opening up about all of this. Even if you've done it a bunch of times, obviously you could see it in your eyes, in your cheeks, in your emotions, and everything that obviously this is a challenging conversation. And so the fact that you're able to do this and share it with the world, I think is special. It's certainly courageous. And so thank you.
It's my honor, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Motivated Mind with your host, Scott Lynch. I hope you enjoyed our deep dive into overcoming adversity at its highest level with Cheryl Hunter. If you did, share it, shout it out on social media, or drop a rating and review. Stay connected with me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Motivated Scott. Don't forget to join me every Monday and Thursday for new episodes. I love you all, and thanks so much for listening. The Motivated Mind is a Legacy Division.